Good afternoon. You're listening to KFSK News for Thursday, July 23rd. I'm Taylor Heckert. Petersburg's dance troupe is fundraising $300,000 to buy the church building they've been using as a studio for years. Mitkoff Dance Troupe has been interested in buying the building ever since services ended at St. Andrew's Episcopal Church last July. But Executive Director Olivia Reed says the organization encountered a hurdle.
Our challenge right now is that because we are a nonprofit run by a volunteer board, securing a traditional bank loan is very, very difficult.
That means Mitkoff Dance Troupe has turned to fundraising to cover the cost of buying the building. They're looking for grant funding and individual donations. Reed says the Episcopal Diocese of Alaska has been working with the dance troupe to figure out the sale. She says right now there's no hard fundraising deadline.
The church has been really wonderful, and they do want to work with us to sell us the building because they see the value in this space.
She says the building has been a longtime home for the dance troupe, who have invested money into improving the space. The building also means a lot to the kids that use it.
I think for a lot of the kids, especially the ones that have been there forever, it's just really, really familiar, and it kind of feels like home. They can walk from their other sports. They can walk from school. There's a space they can hang out and do homework if they need to, in between classes.
Mitkoff Dance Troupe has an online fundraiser on its website and has $10,000 in matching funds available from a local nonprofit through September. Reed says the dance troupe is planning more fundraisers in the coming months. Juneau residents in the Glacial Outburst Flood Zone are preparing for the annual flood expected soon. At a sandbag event in Mendenhall Valley on Saturday, some of that prep work is easier and faster than it was last year. KTOO's Alex Solomon reports.
At Diamond Park, a steady stream of Mendenhall Valley residents drive up to a grid of wooden pallets with around 40 sandbags stacked on each. They're here to try to protect their homes from flooding, with materials offered for free by the City and Borough of Juneau and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Ryan O'Shaughnessy is the city's emergency manager. He says the sandbag event looks a lot different for residents this year than it did last year.
They'd pull in and they'd spend 3 hours here filling up sandbags. And now it's you drive up and we load a pallet or hand load as many sandbags as we can and you're on your way.
That's thanks to an automatic sandbag filling machine provided by the Army Corps.
We turn this on.
A conveyor belt starts rolling. O'Shaughnessy holds an empty white bag under a metal funnel and pulls a lever that drops sand in the bag until it's about two-thirds full. The conveyor belt carries the bag to another worker.
It moves down the line.
Who folds over the top and places it on a pallet.
And so ideally this works best when you have like a team of people, you know, kind of really assembly lining this.
But in just 1 minute, the two of them filled and loaded 5 sandbags. Using the machine cuts down on the time and effort it takes to do it manually with shovels. Stacking sandbags around homes can be an effective way to limit flood damage when done correctly, according to the Army Corps. Adrian and Bob Adadero pull up to receive sandbags. Bob says he recently had a major surgery, and the couple is grateful they don't have to fill sandbags themselves this time.
It was a lot of work.
It was a lot of work.
The Adaderos live on Meander Way, a street that curves around a bend in the river and has been hit hard by flooding in the past.
Well, we've certainly learned a lot. This is our fourth year going into it. We've been flooded three years in a row.
They bought their home just months before the 2023 flood and say they feel the most prepared for it this year. Adrian says the Army Corps' industrial-sized pumps on Meander Way have a lot to do with that.
We are very hopeful year because we have that pump. And hopefully, you know, if any water gets in the yard, it's going to be pumped back over into the river.
They say they plan to evacuate this year, but they were home in 2024 when the most disastrous flood tore through their neighborhood.
It sounds like lightning because the
trees breaking
and it's really spooky. Yeah, so I don't know. I suggest people not sit and wait to watch this thing. It's extremely dangerous.
The National Weather Service predicts that Suicide Basin, the glacial lake responsible for producing the flood, will fill to the top between August 5 and 10. The flood starts when water pressure in Suicide Basin builds up so much that it bores through the ice and floats Mendenhall Glacier, releasing billions of gallons of water into the suburban valley below. It typically begins within a week after the basin is full, but it can happen at any time. The city and Army Corps are offering free sandbags to residents in the flood zone at Diamond Park every Saturday until the flood. In Juneau, I'm Alex Solomon.
Bristol Bay's set netting used to be dominated by women. When the fisheries permit system started in the 70s, it had the highest rate of women permit holders in the state. But that's changed over the decades, and one researcher is digging into the decline and why it isn't happening anywhere else. KDLG's Jesse Sheldon reports.
June Ingram has fished the same family set net site in Ekuk for over 60 years. Her grandfather first came to Bristol Bay as a winter watchman for a cannery.
My grandfather, who was from Denmark, came to Bristol Bay, and he was a winter watchman for a cannery. And then he came to Ekuk in 1939 and staked this property, this site.
Even though it was her grandfather who first staked the site, Ingram says things looked a little different when he first showed up.
He said there were all women on the beach, but he was the first man.
Ingram says set netting sites in Bristol Bay have traditionally been operated by women, which allowed them to multitask, fishing both commercially and for their families.
The reason why women stayed on the shore was to also subsist, not only put up fish, smoked fish, but also to pick the greens and herbs and berries as the seasons came along.
But the number of women set netters in Bristol Bay is declining. In the mid-70s, when limited entry permits were first issued, 57% of set net permits were allocated to women. Today, only 34% are. Amy Burnett Cross is a postdoc fellow in economics at the University of Alaska Anchorage, researching women's participation in the labor force. She spent much of the last year crunching the numbers on set net permit holders in Bristol Bay to better understand why this decline is happening.
The other piece that we are interested in as economists is to think more broadly about why we're seeing something so different in the trend than we're seeing in almost every other high-wage occupation in the economy.
She says women's participation in most other high-wage industries has increased. Cross's research is still underway, but she has two primary hypotheses. First, as more high-paying economic opportunities open up for women elsewhere, they become more likely to exit.
As the economy develops within Bristol Bay and as local women move to Anchorage and other parts of Alaska, they have access to opportunities in jobs where they're earning higher wages or their employer is not allowing them to come back and fish during fishing season. That kind of pull away from the fishery is accelerating women's decline.
The other factor is the decline of shore-based buyers in Bristol Bay.
If they no longer have someone to sell fish to on the shore, then they're forced to now deliver on a tender or find another buyer.
She says a lot of women set netters are caregiving while fishing and don't have the flexibility to leave their site. June Ingram remembers her first summer of set netting in Ekuk with her mother when she was 10 years old.
My mother was Yupik. And they didn't have jobs or childcare. When I was growing up, it was always, Mama was always there. Daddy was there too, but he would be hunting and providing for us during the winter. But Mama was always there, even during the summer.
Cross found that when limited entry permits were implemented in the 70s, Bristol Bay had the highest rate of women permit holders anywhere in the state, by a landslide. Cross thinks one federal regulation from 1937 may have helped. The rule required 2 years of residency in Bristol Bay to participate in the set net fishery. She says this regulation protected local access rights for set net sites. Cross also found that women retain Bristol Bay set net permits for much longer than men, often for 30 to 40 years, even as markets change.
So women are more likely to retain permits within the family when permit prices are high, meaning that they're less likely to sell to the highest bidder. They're more likely to probably to be giving their permits to a family member.
For June Ingram in Ekuk, sharing the set net tradition with her family is at the core of her fishing.
We enjoy life. We show our children. We bring them closer together, our families.
For the many Alaskans concerned about the migration of permits to out-of-state hands, Cross says it's vital to examine each fishery individually and to look at the specific pressures women in a fishery face, including Bristol Bay set netters. In Dillingham, I'm Jesse Sheldon.
In less than a month, Alaskans will cast their votes for governor in the primary election. But with 17 candidates, how do you choose? At a speed dating style event in Anchorage on Monday, members of the public got to talk with the gubernatorial hopefuls. As Alaska Public Media's Hannah Floor reports, voters wanted policy specifics and clear answers.
People are slowly filtering into the banquet hall of a downtown Anchorage hotel. They're wearing suits and silk scarves and extra tufts and red suspenders. There are appetizers, and there's white wine and red wine and rosé.
I didn't know there were going to be chocolate chip cookies, so this is just an added bonus.
That's Andy Holloman, former Anchorage school board member. He's here to ask candidates about education. He says he's always been impressed by how accessible Alaska's politicians are. That's the goal of the event. It's basically political speed dating. Each of the nearly one dozen participating candidates sit at their designated tables, and groups of people cycle through, asking questions. Commonwealth North, a long-standing nonpartisan policy organization, put the event together. It's the first of many, the organizers say. And despite pouring rain and the $50 ticket, it's at capacity. Lee Butterfield is a teacher at South High School in Anchorage. He says his top priority is a pension for public workers. A lot of his students end up in public sector jobs in the lower 48, he says, where there is a pension system.
I watch them leave, and a lot of them want to come home, but it's not there. There's no security to come back.
He says he wants a chance to talk to candidates face to face. Politicians tell you what you want to hear, he says. It's hard to make the right choice.
It's definitely not gut instinct, so I'm going to ask as many questions as I can in order to try to get them to slip up somewhere.
Why isn't it gut instinct?
Oh, my gut instincts are terrible.
If you will look at your name tags, each of you will have a...
Guests and candidates find their assigned seating. All around the room, people are asking questions about plans to improve education, the need for more natural gas, the permanent fund dividend, fisheries. Republican candidate Bernadette Wilson finishes up a discussion about trawling. She says the topics don't surprise her.
No, it's the same questions we've been asking governor candidates for 10, 20, and 30 years, right?
But Tarn Coffee has something different for Democratic candidate Jonathan Christ Tompkins. A simple question, he says.
So I'm a farmer. That's what I do, grow things. What is the plan to address that agriculture's been underrepresented?
Christ Tompkins says he needs to learn more about the issue. He doesn't have the background like he does with fishing. Farmed fish? A man offers from across the table, winking.
Yeah. I'm going to not take note of that heresy, Bernie.
After an hour or so of cycling between tables and refilling wine and steady chatter, the event comes to an end. But people cluster together, continuing conversations. Sean Williams says he still doesn't know who he's going to vote for.
No, I don't. But you know, it's early, so I've got time.
There are issues he really cares about, but he says strategy is important. He wants to vote for someone who can win. Likeability is a big part of that, he says.
Like, you have to have the sizzle. If you don't have the sizzle, you're not going to win.
Christine Hopkins says the event helped her narrow down top contenders. She says not many candidates gave her straight answers. She heard the same thing from most of them. Let's get Alaska back on track. Think about future generations.
They're all saying that. But what does that mean, and how are they going to solve that?
The banquet hall empties out, but Republican candidate Adam Crum is still chatting by the door. He says he appreciated having time to go in depth with people on so many topics.
You've got groups across the board addressing questions about Alaska, and that is important. That is a dialogue that must never end. If we ever stop talking, then we're in tremendous amount of trouble.
It felt like a very Alaskan event, he says. In Anchorage, I'm Hannah Floor.
For KFSK, I'm Taylor Heckert.